Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our post-election discussion. As you know, Carolyn Overington and Aaron Patrick were here before the election, and we thought, Anne and I thought, we'd ask them back after the election, because the first function was so popular, we thought we'd do it again. And so we have Carolyn Overington, the Associate Editor of The Australian, and Aaron Patrick, the Deputy Editor of The Australian Financial Review. We'll lead off with Aaron. He'll speak for about 15 minutes, then Carolyn for about 15 minutes. Questions and discussion follow, and the topic is the 2016 election, the aftermath. Aaron Patrick, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Jared. Well, look, thanks, everyone, for coming out in this winter night. I was hoping to canvass on. Four areas tonight. First one is: did the elites get it wrong? Did they call the election wrong? The debate over what went wrong, the lessons, and what happens next. I don't know about you, but I was really stunned sitting there on Saturday night watching the first results come in with some Liberal friends. And particularly those, I think it was the first result which really shocked me, was the 10% swing in Lyons in Tasmania. And the people around me did what, you know, normal rational human beings did, which was write it off as an aberration. And they were wrong. And what we had here was, a pretty significant failure of elite opinion to understand what most Australians were thinking, and to misinterpret what was going on in the election campaign. This stemmed from a number of reasons. Partly it was underestimating Bill Shorten and the Labor campaign. Partly it was underestimating the willingness of Australians to push back against a first-term government that hadn't made any particularly spectacular mistakes. But you also had a sort of media elite feedback loop where you had senior people in the media being told information by the parties. And the information that was coming out was that the coalition was going to win. And I spoke to a cabinet minister on the Friday who I've known for a long time and whose judgment I trusted. And he said, yeah, look, I think we're going to come in with about 82 seats. And I believe that because, not only because I trust the individual, but because that's what people have been saying in the media. And so the elites, and I include myself in this category, got the wrong. And you saw what was happening in the polls. Essentially, what the elites were doing was discounting the polls, because the polls showed that the event was going to be narrow result than it really was. And so there was a rationalisation going on, which was national polls don't work anymore, because they can't, by dint of their size, inform us as to what's going on in specific seats, and because of the changing nature of society, primarily with younger people not using landlines, there was a general belief and elite opinion that those polls had become less reliable indicator. But turns out the polls were pretty good. Ipsos and News Poll, I think, got the primary vote within one percentage point. I think Ipsos was quite close, at least on the primary vote. And what you saw was elite opinion influencing the betting markets, and you saw the Labor Party out to $8. And the coalition, someone might correct me here, but I think it was down to 120, right? It may have even been narrower than that.
108.
It was 108. I thought it was 108. Yeah, so it was that. So my first point is, we got it wrong. Okay. And that is a really sobering lesson for us. Okay. What's more important, though, is what went wrong. And how did one of the most intelligent, talented men of his generation, of a generation of Australians, who took power with this enormous feeling of enthusiasm behind him in the community, you know, across all parts of society almost, in such a short time, how did he lose Australia? How did he lose Australians? Now, look, there is no one answer, and we're going to be debating this, I think, for years. But the debate itself at the moment is pretty fascinating. You've got this group, a not insubstantial group in the Liberal Party, arguing he wasn't conservative enough. You have other people arguing he wasn't liberal enough. You have people saying his campaign was ineffective. You've got people saying he wasn't aggressive enough. And I don't know the answer, but it's pretty interesting. You look at the right of the Liberal Party, and essentially what they're saying is that he needed to be more Abbott-like. Not only did he need to go more aggressive, more negative, but he needed to campaign on those key conservative issues like Islamic immigration, refugees, boat people, national security, things like that. And they argue that he would have kept all those Western Sydney seats if he had it. Then you've got this other quite, I think, legitimate argument, which is, well, he inherited the 2014 budget of Tony Abbott and Joe Hockey and didn't largely repudiate it. And so there's definitely an argument to be had that Australians were uncomfortable with the kind of classical liberal policy that that Malcolm Turnbull and his cabinet have implemented. And I think you had the Prime Minister out today in a way acknowledging that, because his key argument, I think, this press conference this afternoon was there's a very clear message about the importance of health policy in Australian society. Now, we like Medicare as much as the Labor Party, is what he said. We need to send a clearer demonstration of our commitment to that. Now, people on the right and economic rationalists would say the healthcare system is unfundable under this current policy settings. You've got the doctors. I think there's an argument that the doctors are gaming the system, or at least doctor opposition to changes to health policy are primarily designed to protect their incomes. Okay, and I think, you know, and there's an academic argument, legitimate academic argument to be waged, that making people pay in small amounts to visit a doctor can be decent policy. Okay, but clearly the politics have been lost on that. Okay, so this was going to cause a reassessment of what's politically doable in terms of changing, I'd say reforming, but in terms of modernising healthcare policy, which we, most of us, are paying a huge amount through our taxes to support. Okay, organisational issues, I think, are pretty dull, but really important. Why did the Liberal Party not pre-select candidates in some of those Western Sydney seats until the campaign started? You know, that's absurd. Why did no candidates all have years out there working their communities and getting themselves known? Why did Jamie Briggs may have cost this government its majority. Jamie Briggs, brilliant young man, he played a key role in Howard's office under Work Choices, stellar career, and then he's going and trying to pick up some diplomat in Hong Kong. Because of that, he lost the seat of Mayo, a seat that never should have lost. So why is it these privileged men in this party don't have the discipline to behave themselves when they're in a position of power? I think that's a legitimate question that has to be asked. Okay, let's go to the lessons. And this election just had some incredibly powerful lessons for how politics works. And for me, the key lesson is fear is effective. Fear is a fantastic driver of voting behaviour. fear, and no matter if that fear is underpinned by a colossal lie or exaggeration, fear is a great way to get what you want. And I think that was one of Bill Shorten's great contributions to political understanding in Australia, which was the Medicare camp, the Medicare campaign, as you know, elite opinion will tell you, was absurd. Okay, what's so wrong with improving the efficiency of the payment system for Medicare, which is doling out tens of billions of dollars a year? And the government's inability, even though almost immediately they promised, they dropped their own internal policy of modernising part of it. Straight away they said, look, we're not going to touch it, we're going to let the public servants continue to run it. And that just didn't work. And Shorten was able to make hay from that very effectively. Now, you know, let's be honest here, this isn't just Labor who does this. The right side of politics has been very good at doing this as well. Look at the children overboard that happened under the Howard government. So this is a bipartisan approach to politics. So the question is, was Turnbull naive? Was he too comfortable? Did Turnbull think, yeah, I can lose 10 seats, but I'm going to do it and be a good guy about it, or I'm not going to go out there and run an overly negative campaign because it'll undermine my own persona, and I'll have much stronger legitimacy post the election if I can win without running scare campaigns. And he had plenty of scare campaigns available. He had scare options, you know. He had the union movement, which, you know, he could have pushed hard on, the CFMEU. He had Bill Shorten's background in the union movement. He had material which had been generated through the Royal Commission into trade unions. He had the threat of refugees coming by boats. And they played a little bit of that with the Daily Telegraph. He had the budget. He had a blowout in taxes. So anyway, he had these ploys I think he could have deployed, and he didn't, and he's lost because of it. Another really key insight as to what we've learned is the electorate forgets. The electorate has got a short memory. Because a few years ago, and we discussed this in the pre-election presentation we had here, Bill Shorten was persona non grata. Bill Shorten had brought down two Labor prime ministers. He helped bring down Australia's first female prime minister. He had a long history of dodgy behaviour in the union movement. And suddenly now he's been hailed. He's been hailed as a potential prime minister. So I think it shows that if you've got a chutzpah, you can do anything in politics. And I think, you know, that's a credit to Bill Shorten's political skills. So what happens next? Well, bold prediction here. I think there'll be a minority Liberal government. They may or may not enter a sort of formal pact with the crossbenchers. Suspect they won't. And going out further on a limb, I think a minority Liberal government could possibly be relatively stable. Remember when we had the hung parliament in 2010? And I, like many other people, expected to be incredibly unstable. And turned out not to be at all. In fact, as time went on, Gillard was able to increase her position in the House of Representatives. And from a legislative point of view, she governed quite effectively. And I think there's an argument that could happen here. Of course, though, and part of the reason I think other people believe that is because you saw the share market went up about 20 points yesterday. Today it was down a bit, okay? But surely the share market isn't particularly rattled. Now, what will happen in the Senate is going to be absolutely fascinating. I predict you'll have Hinch may form a sort of voting bloc with Xenophon, or at least vote along with them. I think Xenophon, in a way, I think this will be a more manageable Senate than the previous one, because I think Xenophon is a deal doer. Xenophon wants to get credit for changing things, and therefore he's open to do deals. And I think he's a far more adept politician than Clive Palmer ever was, and therefore be able to manage his own people better. And may well be that Darren Hinch is probably a pragmatic guy. You know, he's been around a long time. He's got, you know, he's a known quantity. I would assume that Darren Hinch should be open to discussing deals on policy. So I guess what I'm arguing is you've got some rational political actors in the Senate who the government will be able to work with. Then you've got Pauline Hanson and Jackie Lambie. There's got to be a natural fit between Lambie and Hanson, right? And it'll be absolutely fascinating to see if they form a, you know, anti-Islamic voting bloc together. But they're protesters. They're not engagers. And so, so how Hansen uses the platform of the Senate, and it's an incredibly powerful platform, to promote herself and her ideology of division and hate, religious hate and religious intolerance, is probably one of the most dangerous things that's emerged from this election. And if she forms a, you know, an alliance with Lambie, she'll be even more potent. Anyway, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Aaron. So, Caroline Overington, thank you.
Isn't he great? You know, he does that with almost no notes. He just has a few scribbles on that pad. I'm not quite like that. People keep asking me, what have I done to my nose? I literally ran into a door. Now, when you say you ran into a door, nobody believes you. I actually literally did. It was a glass door and it was side on and I just didn't see it. So that's what it is, no gossip. Anyway, here we are. Who expected to be here quite like this? Not me. Last time we were here, I think you did yourself a disservice in your little presentation today. I think we did predict a little uncertainty. We were pretty unhappy about the way Malcolm was campaigning last time we were here and the campaign that he was running. But I do think that we both expected a Conservative victory. And we don't have that. Today we have talk of a hung parliament, possibly a minority government. The government, for ease of reference, I will refer to the coalition as the government. Now, they have made a big song and dance over the years, as we know, about how it's not legitimate to string a bunch of independents together and call it a government. I was looking at some quotes today from George Brandis, who said the government that Labor managed to cobble together last time had about the legitimacy of the Pakistani cricket team. And Joe Hockey described it as such. It's an illegitimate government. It is the first time since World War II that we have had a government that is inherently unstable because it is illegitimate. And Christopher Pyne, my favourite, said, I think it's fair to say that Julia Gillard has never been elected by the Australian public to be Prime Minister. She has independence giving her the job. And that is precisely the situation we face with Malcolm Turnbull today. Suddenly a hung parliament does indeed look very legitimate. And of course we've had the double dissolution to shake up the Senate, and now we have a Senate that looks like the bar scene from Star Wars. One big surprise, Darren Hinch. One of my favourite books ever, or one of my favourite writers ever, F. Scott Fitzgerald, said there are no second acts. Darren Hinch, he is on his 47th public act. We're talking about a man here who edited a newspaper that no longer exists, who was the host of a TV program that is no longer on air, and who has in fact actually died. And yet he now has a seat in the Senate, and that has not slowed him down. New liver, new life. Which reminds me, two of the incoming senators have done time. What a country! What a country we live in. And like Aaron, like you, I expected today to talk about the result. But we have no result other than that minority government. So I've decided to give my speech not in four parts, but in three parts. I'm going to be more efficient than you over there at the AFR. More efficient than Fairfax. I'm going to talk about the campaign. Then I'm going to talk about the election night speech, which was awful. And then I'm going to talk about the aftermath. I was going to call it the afterglow, but there's been no afterglow, so I gave that up. The first thing I think we have to acknowledge is that Malcolm Turnbull turned out to be a terrifically poor campaigner. This from the guy that was meant to be the great communicator. Remember that? He's the debating champion. He turned out to be a terrible campaigner. He could not cut through, and certainly not in the way that Tony Abbott could. The media was absolutely sick of stop the votes. No question we were sick of that. But at least you remembered it, right? You knew what he stood for, and you knew what he meant, and you also knew that when he said something, he meant it. Now, I was intrigued by an article that I saw earlier this week in the Sydney Morning Herald by Matthew Knott, who was on Turnbull's campaign bus. Now, that's the bus that goes around to the electorates with journalists on board, and that's where you see all your pictures from. That's where you get your daily pictures from. He said, or described, the campaign bus as languid. You'd get on at around 10 a.m, they'd visit one electorate, and then they'd stop for lunch. Malcolm would have the dumplings at the Chinese restaurant, and then they'd call it a day. Some days they'd knock off at noon. The Thursday before the poll, Malcolm did not campaign at all. At all. The Thursday before the campaign. And on the Friday before the campaign, He knocked off at 2 o'clock. Now, by contrast, Bill Shorten is still going. I don't know whether you've seen him today. He is out in a shopping centre today kissing babies. He is still campaigning. And my favourite thing today, has anyone seen this picture? This is Matt Thistleway, who won his seat with something like a 20% margin. He's ALP. And he's out there today with a handwritten sign, standing on the side of the road, saying thank you to his electorate. This is what campaigning looks like. That grassroots stuff actually works. Getting out there and talking to your constituents actually works. Being humble about the fact that these people put you in the parliament actually works. I was amazed to see the pace at which Malcolm was prepared to move. Because who remembers Tony Abbott in 2010 saying, I'm going to go all night. I will not stop campaigning for the next 24 hours. The journalists were on the bow lines of the ferry, exhausted, almost dead, and he was still going. And he said in that final week, I will go for every single vote. And it seemed like Malcolm didn't want them at all. And I was astounded. Whatever else you knew about Tony Abbott, you knew that he wanted it. He really wanted it, badly. And with Turnbull, throughout the campaign, I got the impression that for a politician, he somehow saw himself as being above politicking. But you have to do the politicking. Did anyone see Turnbull with Annabelle Crabb on Kitchen Cabinet? What a performance. Now, here is someone who is not going to give you a hard run. She's not out for the jugular. She's out to sit down in your kitchen, magnificent kitchen, to help you communicate with your viewers. She brought along brownies made partly of miso. Can you think of anything more disgusting? Really disgusting, right? And she called them the double miso-lution brownies, which is like the worst joke ever, but you can work with that, right? If you're a politician, you work with that. You taste it, you pretend that it looks nice, you make a terrible face at the camera. He looked so irritated, didn't laugh at any of the jokes, didn't even try to smile. And I thought to myself, Turnbull, you don't necessarily need her vote, but you need the votes of everybody watching. But it was like he didn't want them. The other things about Turnbull's campaign that I thought fell really flat were in particular the dad ad. Do you remember the dad ad about how much he loves his dad? We complained about this last time we were here, that he insists on pretending that he is from a disadvantaged background. And it doesn't work. It works for somebody like Bill Clinton because it's true. If you go to Hope, Arkansas, you can see the house that Bill Clinton grew up in, and it is a shack. It barely has windows. He was raised by, his mother was gone almost the day he was born, and his father before he was even born, raised by grandparents in the arse end of the world. It's actually true. Everything that he did himself, up by the bootstraps. And it was kind of true of Kevin Rudd as well. He did grow up in a broken home. He did have a single mum. They did spend some time a little bit homeless. He went to Nambour High. These things are actually true. But with Turnbull, it's just not true. And the night before the poll, David Spears, who is perhaps the best political commentator we have in the country, sat down with a bunch of undecided voters who had just watched the Turnbull ad and the Turnbull speech at the National Press Club and said, what do you think? And to a man, every one of them, all 12, said he's insincere. He sounds fake. He's out of touch. He doesn't get it. Because if you run those kind of ads, that is the response that people will have. They will think that you are out of touch. Because there are actually in our community, whether we like it or not, people living far out in Western Sydney, 10 people to a house, with everybody relying on disability pensions, with somebody in prison, with a teenage daughter who's pregnant and dropped out of school. This is a fact. And those people vote. And when you talk to them about Turnbull's upbringing, they do not believe that he was impoverished. So it's not just me saying that, it's them saying that. The fake tradie. Have we heard from him today? What has happened to the fake trading? If that wasn't the worst intervention in a campaign, I don't want to see what the worst one is. And I waited the whole campaign to see a solid conservative attack on Labor. And it never came. On borders, on deeper deficits, and on more tax. And it never came. In politics, you win by walking through the front door. You stand on the front foot. You cannot work from defence. If you are defensive, you will not win. It's like soccer. You have to score a goal. You have to get out there on the attack. Tony Abbott knows how to campaign. He won 5 seats the first time in 2010, and by the end of it, he'd won 18. And that buffer is completely gone. In 9 months, gone, dissolved. No question Mediscare had something to do with the result. Absolutely no question about it. It was a scandal and it was a fraud. And Wayne Swan's daughter was behind it, we read in The Australian. My colleague Pamela Williams has broken that story yesterday. I think formerly your colleague, Aaron, let her go. The news on that one. But the coalition cannot sit back and let something like Mediscare run like a rabbit for a week. You just can't do it. You have to get out there and stomp on that nonsense, and you have to stomp on it hard. And for some reason, he didn't have the guts to do it. So now to the speech on the night. I have had a lot to say about the speech. I was very upset about the speech because, like many of you, I stayed up for that.
Yes.
I stayed up for that. And I was really annoyed. And he looked to me, first of all, like he was hiding in the mansion, which was a bad look. And secondly, like he was hiding from the result. And you can't hide from the result because you're responsible for the result. And when you're responsible for something, you have to own it. You have to own it and apologise for it. And he didn't want to do that. He has done a bit of that today. He's taken full responsibility for both the campaign and for the result. But the things that annoyed me about the speech on the night, he did not offer any commiserations to people who died in a ditch for him. There are a number of Conservatives who will not be returning to Canberra because they campaigned for Malcolm Turnbull. And he had nothing to say to them. And that, to me, is wrong. Peter Hendy and Wyatt Roy put him into the Prime Ministership and they are both gone, or likely gone. And that seemed to me worth a nod from him. He also didn't thank his supporters. Now, I was particularly anguished for the people who spent all of that time in those windswept courtyards handing out those how-to-vote cards that he didn't find the time to thank. And I got a letter from one of them today. I'll read it to you. It says, Caroline, I was one of those bone-weary volunteers in Melbourne wearing the daggy blue T-shirt in a windswept school ground, and I can tell you I wasn't there for 9 hours. I was there for 12, including the time taken to set up the booth before the 8 a.m. votes. I worked all day. I took no break and I get no pay and there was no right respite and I got quite a bit of our abuse because of our limited resources on that particular side of town. He didn't say thank you to me and I thought that was ungracious. This is your supporters. This is your base. That's what they think of you. Which brings me to the afterglow or the aftermath. The Australian people have absolutely spoken and it is going to take some time to figure out what they said. A couple of heartwarming results, I thought. I make an entirely biased observation when I say this is great for newspapers. Absolutely fantastic results we've seen online all week. We've seen off Rob Oakeshott. I think that's a good thing. I don't think his heart was in it. He's actually training to be a doctor, as our reporter Shari Markson went out there and did an interview with him. He's at school being a doctor. I don't think he was in it. I'm glad to see that that's done. And also Tony Windsor is gone.
Yes.
Now, I watched amazed when Tony Windsor turned on an old friend during the campaign who had complained about him backing the government and said, oh, well, the Vietnam War does odd things to people. And I thought that was the measure of that man. He came across as terrifically bitter, and I think we've got a good result there. We've got a Prime Minister saying he can still form a government. He's going to need to do some deals with the Conservatives, obviously. I'm a bit worried about the price. What's the price of government? The Independent, Bob Catter, one of those people he's going to have to deal with, has said he's already got a list. It has 20 points on it. 20 points. And he told The Australian today, the people at the centre will have immense power, and I certainly intend to use mine. In the Senate, we'll have Hinch, obviously, and Hanson. And Hanson wants a ban on the full burqa. She wants it stopping the building of all mosques. And she wants a royal commission into Islam. None of this is going to happen. So going forward, what Malcolm Turnbull actually has to do is reconnect with his base. And in my view, he does that by reversing the changes to the superannuation, which were a disaster for him today. But he also has to get back on the front foot. Now, he fell into the hole again today when Bill Shorten was threatening him about Medicare. He then went on the TV and said, I pledge not to do anything with Medicare. You need to find the front foot and get on it, not being reactive to the Labor Party all the time. This is absolutely not the ending that Turnbull wanted. But he has taken some of the right steps today. Well, they're in the right direction in any case. And I think we need to bear in mind that he had never run a campaign for the Lodge before. Neither of them had, in fact. This was a very rare situation that we had where neither party had run a campaign for the Lodge before. It is good to see some signs that he is learning. But in my view, I have always believed that you can't teach someone who thinks they have nothing to learn. And that seems to be his Achilles heel, his central character flaw. But I don't want to end on that note. I wanted to end on a fun note. And to that end, I have the Bill Leake cartoon. It's midnight on election night. Lucy is shaking Malcolm. Did anyone see this? She's shaking Malcolm. She's saying, wake up, it's time to make your speech. And he says, how long have I been asleep? And she says, 8 weeks, Malcolm. Oh, 8 long weeks. Thank you so much.
Many thanks to Aaron Patrick and Carolyn Overton. So we've got about 30 minutes. Before I start questions and discussion, thank King and Wood Morrisons for the use of this fine facility this evening. And so we come to questions. I think, Carolyn, if you come over here, Aaron, you come over here, and I'll soon depart. Just going back to Carolyn's point, David Spears' live focus group on Sky News last Thursday night, and you mentioned the comments they made about Malcolm Turnbull. The same group also made very positive comments about Tony Abbott. And therefore, I don't think Tony Abbott's going to return to the Liberal leadership, and you don't know what would have happened. But there does appear to be some evidence that someone like Tony Abbott would have done better in Western Sydney, in Northern Tasmania, in parts of Queensland, just like Barnaby Joyce did extremely well in northern New South Wales and also parts of Victoria. Do you think that's valid, or do you think that doesn't really mean anything because it's just something that never happened, so we don't know? So let's start with Carolyn, go to Aaron, and then we'll go to the rest of the room.
You know, that is the question that I think we posited last time we were here. The question that the coalition is asking themselves today, would we have done better under Tony Abbott? And as I said last time we were here, there are things that we don't know and that we will never know. But it does seem to me that Tony Abbott knows how to campaign and he knows how to win seats. We know that because he won 5 and then he won 18. So we know that he knows how to not only win seats, but also how to win government. It's very interesting with Conservatives, I think. They have tried in a way to copy the progressive side of politics playbook. And when progressives want to win government, they try to reach into the middle. Tony Blair was one of the first politicians to do that very successfully. Bill Clinton also did that, called it triangulation, where they reach into the middle from the left. And to some extent, Kevin Rudd did that very successfully too. But remember, he was the economic conservative. We have to stop all of this spending of money. I don't know whether you've all spent your checks yet. But before he got in, it was all about, we have to stop the terrible spending. I am an economic rationalist. I am an economic conservative. Now, the Liberal Party, the conservative side of politics, when they try to do that, is risky. When you try to reach for the middle, it's risky. Because if you take a step to the left, your base is annoyed. So you need, in my opinion, if you're conservative, you need to go that way, not towards the middle, that way. That's the way you're, that's where you can hoover up some votes, and perhaps not in this section here.
I think that's a great point, but also Tony Abbott did know how to campaign, but so did Peter Credle and Brian Lochner.
Oh, right.
So you know, Tony Abbott had an effective team with him. The thing about Tony Abbott is that Tony Abbott appeals to the One Nation crowd, you know, and Western Sydney, in part. You know, Tony Abbott is a proud conservative. You know, he's a proud Christian man, and you know, he resonates. And this, you know, and this, And you can cut through in those conservative communities, which I think you very clearly explained, you know, view Malcolm Turnbull with suspicion as this eastern suburbs elitist, which he is. But on the flip side is that I think with a Tony Abbott as leader, they would have lost 3 seats in Victoria. Yeah, so pros and cons, right?
There's a question here.
Mitch Frost, I've known Malcolm for 25-plus years. He couldn't make up his mind then, he can't make up his mind now. The problem with him, he's just a lousy politician. He might be a brilliant businessman, but he's a lousy politician. He doesn't have a killer instinct, which was the same as Brendan Nelson, who was the nicest bloke you could ever meet. And, I mean, we should have learned by what happened with Godwin Gretsch. I mean, look what happened then. Absolute waste of time. Didn't know what he was doing. They got rid of him then. I mean, and what do? They put him back in again.
Okay, we got the point. Do you want to respond?
Look, I don't disagree with you that he doesn't have the killer instinct. I think Malcolm is a really fascinating psychological study, which is why there's been so many books written about him. But one of the things that's interesting to me is that he wants to be loved. And if you're in the business, that's politics is the wrong business, because 50% of the population will hate you all the time and some of your own supporters sometimes. So if you want to be loved, I think you've got to go and run the Red Cross. I don't think you can do what it is that he's doing. And so that's interesting. But I would pick up on the point that Aaron made. Peter Credlin has had the fastest rehabilitation of any person, I think, in Australian public life ever. And she's not only had a magnificent rehabilitation from the smears against her character and against her personally, but she has been entirely vindicated as a political campaigner who knows what she's talking about.
Aaron, you want to make a comment?
Well, look, I'd say about Turnbull, maybe we should give him a chance.
He hasn't changed. 25 years.
Okay. Aaron, you got the floor. Okay.
That's okay.
Jacqueline.
First of all, congratulations, Caroline, for picking the sleeper issue. You said the last time you were speaking here that it was super, and everybody has confirmed that. Michael Kroger mentioned that on the night. So well done to you both for the calls that you did make. You talked about, and I think the gentleman here kind of alluded to it, we talk about judgment and sticking with decisions. And I don't know if you all noticed, but during the campaign, PM would have this fellow going around to footy clubs and netball clubs on a Friday night and talking to them and getting their sort of take on what it is to be a leader and how's the campaign going. And on the night before the election, on the Friday night, the standout for me was that a lot of people in Wagga and those sorts of areas that one might consider depressed were saying, these blokes have got to stick to their guns. They have to make tough decisions and they have to tell us, you know, even though we don't like it, they have to explain it to us. And as a netball coach, when I'm coaching my ladies out on the field, I have to stick with any decision I make. So everyone was alluding it to in the old-fashioned Australian way to sport. But I think this is the point that you have worked on in both your presentations, and certainly one I think has come through in the vote. I'd like your thoughts on that.
So, sorry, exactly what point? That was a long, long statement. What precise point do you want me to respond to?
What you were making about the modern politician not sticking to decisions, and I think you're saying about wanting to be loved, not actually understanding what the purpose of a politician was. Still, I think that we can use all sorts of tricks that of the trade in politicking, but at the end of the day, it comes down to, as these sports people were saying, or as the coaches were saying, having a decision, having a game plan, accepting that 50% of the population is not going to enjoy whatever you've said.
Yes, I think I get it now. I guess what you're saying is, you know, how about the argument for politicians of principle? I think this election pretty much destroyed that. I think this election showed, as I said, that fear campaigns and fear campaigns work, stoking resentment, stoking class warfare, misleading about your opposition's policies, playing to people's worst prejudices, and I'm not talking just about Labor Party here, I'm talking about One Nation, and I think I think if Turnbull had had enough years to build up, you know, a reputational or establish a strong policy record, that might have worked. But he had just been there too short a time, and he'd largely been enacting the policies laid down by Abbott that he was unable to win over people as a basis of a man of principle. It was too early for him.
Carol, do you want to add to that?
I like this notion of being too early to go along with your principles. They're either principles or they're not. And if you hold them dearly, you hold them dearly. It seemed to me that what Malcolm needed to do was go early. He should have gone on Valentine's Day. He should have gone on the 14th of February when he had the bulk of the population with him, when there was a lot of hope in the air, there was a lot of a willingness to give him a go. Now we would be 4 or 5 months into a Turnbull prime ministership, and we may well be seeing a conviction politician, because he would feel like, I have 3 years, there are some things I would like to do, and I'm going to give them a run in the paddock. I'm going to take them out, and I'm going to try and sell these policies, in fact, try to bring some of them in. What he tried to do, or what I think what Brandis encouraged him to do, was at its heart deceitful. He wanted to throw open both houses of Parliament, come back with enough numbers in both houses to pass whatever legislation they wanted for a long period of time. And the Australian public was not prepared to let them do it. And therein lies the problem. They tried to pull a Swiftie, and the public doesn't like it.
Dimitri.
Thanks for your comments. You've spoken not unjustifiably of Malcolm Turnbull's failures in this campaign, but you haven't spoken much about his main consigliere's, Tony Nutt and Arthur Sinodinos, or about the actual Labor machine in opposition. You can make some comments, please.
You know, I don't know enough about that, sorry, to say that backroom stuff is pretty opaque. And because I'm an editor in the office, I don't get enough insight into that. So I probably shouldn't answer. Sorry.
You mean Tony Nutt and the back room behind Bill Shorten? Bill Shorten's people were clearly more experienced. And anyone who watched any portion of the Channel 7 broadcast, I know it's difficult to watch everything, but I was trying to flip between Sky primarily, which I thought was fantastic. Lee Sales, I thought, on the ABC was great. Channel 9, I thought, was good fun. But 7 had Sam Dastyari. Yeah. And I have never seen a more skilled person in terms of knowing the seats and knowing the players and knowing the issues and the numbers. He was on top of every single detail. I mean, this is a guy who is a politician, but he's clearly the backroom boy. And I was hugely impressed by how much he knew about what it was going to take to win this election, compared to the guys on the Conservative side on the various panels who really didn't seem to know much at all and seemed in some ways to be taken by surprise as the results were coming out. The only person who had an inkling of how badly it was going reasonably quickly, I thought, was Michael Kroger. And Kroger is the role that he's played in this campaign. He's been working really hard in Victoria, and you'll see in Victoria they didn't lose a single... Well, it looks like they haven't lost a single seat. Chisholm's still hanging there, but it looks like it's going to be okay. Last time I looked, 65 votes ahead they were. The coalition was 65 votes ahead in Chisholm.
It's 85 tonight.
Is it 85 tonight? 85. So it's a handful, and then we're going to have to go to the recount.
That's a Labor seat, so they haven't lost it.
Right, exactly. So I think that, yeah, so how whether or not that's going to go his way or not. But it seems to me that the Liberal Party, or the coalition, were convinced that they were going to win and therefore didn't do the level of work required, whereas the Labor Party, always starting as an underdog, were prepared to get out there and do the groundwork.
Right, we go here, then we go there, then down there. Yeah.
My question is about the future of Malcolm Turnbull. Carolyn, your points were really pretty damning and imply that there can be no future. Aaron, I think you said maybe he needs a bit more time. But in reality, will the Liberal Party give him the time if you know, win or lose?
Well, I expect they will. I think if he can put together a minority or a bare majority government, they will, I feel obliged to give him a certain period of time to stabilise the government, map out a new agenda, and prove that he can get things forward. But I don't think he's got an unlimited amount of time. So I guess what I'm saying is he's got to perform relatively quickly to survive.
Carolyn, do you want to make a comment?
You know, at the Australian, we have a pretty conservative readership. I mean, we're a centre-right paper, probably, and our readership would be pretty conservative. And I've been watching some of the reader comments this week, and there isn't a lot of appetite among what I would call the base for the retention of Malcolm Turnbull. A number of commenters are saying that it would have been better for true conservatives for him to have lost. He still might. But to have lost and then enable the party to rebuild as a truly conservative party in opposition, which is often the only place you can do it. On the other hand, power is always good, so a win is always better than a loss. I feel like sometimes I'm not convinced that Malcolm Turnbull wanted to run again in 2019. I think he wanted the words Malcolm Turnbull, Prime Minister of Australia, on his CV, and he's now got them. And I think that being elected in his own right was important to his ego, so that people could not say you only ever took the position and you never won an election. I think he really wanted to win this one. But whether he wanted to govern for a generation or two generations, like Menzies did, or Howard indeed for 10 or 12 years, I'm not convinced. So I think we're on the same page. I don't think that he has a lot of time, and if he does manage to cobble together a government, it may be we're looking at 18 months to 2 years. But you never know. You know, with Howard took a really big blow, I think it was in 98, and then came storming home at the next election, 2001, with Tampa on the horizon, and increased his majority and then continued to do so until ultimately he lost three elections later. So it's entirely possible that it could go either way.
Matt?
I have a big what-if question. If Tony Abbott stayed as Prime Minister, would this election have been won or lost by the Liberals?
Oh, they would have been killed, I reckon. Yeah. Been killed under Abbott.
You know, what is an interesting point about Tony Abbott that I think hasn't been raised yet is Tony Abbott was responsible for a lot of the background work that put Pauline Hanson in prison. Do you remember that? And then he was responsible for the funding of the campaign and so on. She ultimately went to prison. And Tony Abbott is also somewhat involved in the whole James Ashby thing, and James Ashby is now Pauline Hanson's campaign manager. I spoke to their team today, just out of interest. I mean, if somebody puts you in prison, do you feel like working with them? I mean, I don't know. Like, to me...
Didn't Pauline go to prison under Queensland law
for
electoral fraud?
She
did. This was a long way from where Tony Abbott was.
I think he was involved in the funding of the campaign behind the scenes to have the investigation done. I don't know that I'd be caught up on the precise details, but I do remember his name being mentioned. But Pauline Hanson's own team told me today that they always preferred him to Malcolm, that they didn't approve of what the party had done by removing Tony, and that they always preferred Tony as a Prime Minister to Malcolm, who they don't like at all. So it does seem to me that Tony could have a role, and particularly a more important role than he currently has on the backbench. You know he wants to be Defence Minister. He said so to almost everybody in town, except publicly. He wants to be the Defence Minister, and he's in a much better position now to argue for a ministry than he was before.
Question down there.
Yep. Given that the swing against the government was over 5% in New South Wales and twice that of Victoria and Queensland, and that 70% of the electorates where the swing was even greater than 5% were involved in forced council amalgamations. Can you explain that swing except as an angry reaction against the Baird's government policies?
No doubt that the council amalgamations played a role, although it does seem to defy logic, because the federal government quite obviously has no role in amalgamating councils. And the council's amalgamation issue has been planned for many years to make councils more efficient. So that if there were voters switching their vote irrationally, so be it.
Yeah. And I have to give a shout out to Graham and Margaret over here who asked me the same thing. And I wish, but I don't buy it. I know that there are people who, and you're obviously in this group, who passionately believe that the, and that we have more nodding here, that the amalgamation of the councils have encouraged people to vote against the coalition government at a federal level. And it could, you're telling me that you did it, so I have to believe that you did it. But I guess I just didn't see it.
Discussion done.
Yes.
Because in my electorate in North Sydney, I think a lot of this speech
was can't hear you.
Areas, Trent Zimmerman in North Sydney improved his vote.
Did he?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. I really don't think there's any evidence.
But I mean, people are saying that they did it. They did. They in fact voted that way.
Not in the electorates where I know that some of these.
And where I'm standing out, they got nothing.
Oh, well, there we are.
Okay. It's a question down the back. Yeah.
Editorially up front, you make a lot of decisions to put the bulk of your resources towards covering the LNP and the ALP campaigns. How much of this focus and, you know, the fact that you invested a lot of money on having people on the buses with the leaders and photographers following them around, how much of that do you think impacted the failure of the elite to see the result, and would you, from an editorial perspective, run your coverage of the campaign differently next time, learning from this?
Are you referring to maybe we should have devoted more resources to covering other parties?
Yeah, covering other parties and covering marginal electorates, and I'm just wondering whether that's something that you've discussed or something which you'd possibly learn from for next time. Is there anything you'd do different?
We haven't, because of the inconclusive outcome of the election, we haven't sat down and had time to do a post-mortem about our coverage. And we may not do it in a formal sense, but clearly we're always sort of reassessing what we do. The rise of the Xenophon's party was pretty well telegraphed, and I felt was very well covered and fairly covered by the mainstream media, including News Corp and Fairfax. And so I think we got that right. The Greens received a lot of coverage, and they didn't make much of an impact, you know. Sure, they almost got Batman. They didn't really come close in Wills. They're a huge failure in Grandler. And in the Senate, looks like they'll go backwards. Where we didn't, I think the mainstream media, where we didn't cover, and this goes to I think Nick Cater's long-held arguments about the elite media, which is One Nation. So how does media organisations with certain cultural values, primarily based in Sydney and Melbourne, cover Queensland redneck politicians? It's tough, you know, it's tough. But you know, she got. What did she? You know, she got probably two seats. Jackie Lambie got
9% plus.
She got 9%. Jackie Lambie got 8% in Tasmania. So the mainstream media and the ABC in particular, as a state-funded entity, has an obligation to provide fair and non-sneering coverage of all Melbourne society, whether we like them or not. You know, and I think that, you know. So people would say, well, why give Pauline Hanson oxygen? So it's a, you know, but I think it's a very tough issue, but I think we have to face up to it.
Okay, now we've got to move on. Do you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I mean, I work for The Australian. We're a national publication. I think that the names of the people who are going into the parliament are not unknown to you. You know the name Xenophon. That's because we covered it. You know Windsor, because we had him on the front page. You know Oakeshott, we had him on the front page. You're all familiar with Pauline Hanson, because the media covered her. Lambie, you all know who that is, right? Because the media covered. There's no one going into the parliament that is unknown to you. No one. And that is because people are covering these things pretty well, I think. At The Australian, we always say, what do they think in Tutgaruk? Because we have readers in Tutgaruk. So when we're looking at trying to put something on the front page of the paper, let's say, for example, Roger Rogerson is convicted of murder, what are they thinking, Tutgaruk? They don't know who he is. They don't care. So we're trying to make our coverage as balanced and as relevant to readers across the nation as we possibly can, And I think we did a pretty good job, because if there were people going into the parliament that you'd never bloody heard of, that would be a tragedy. But you know most of them, and I think you know what most of them stand for, which suggests that we've done a pretty good job.
Now, a lot of people here, and we've run out of time, so final question. Yep.
Senator Abetz in Tasmania was very bitter and twisted about being demoted. He's a senior person in Tasmania. He's one of the strongest critics of Malcolm Turnbull, and yet his party lost every seat in Tasmania, whereas Kroger won the seat in Victoria. So shouldn't someone be criticising Abetz for partial of the loss in Tasmania?
I'm not sure that that's fair. I'm not sure that Eric Abetz can personally be held responsible for disastrous performance of the Liberal Party and Tasmania. And similarly, I don't know that Michael Kroger can claim credit for the pretty good job they did in Victoria, because what happened there was bigger than two men.
Sharon, do you want to make a point?
Yeah, I think the point about Tasmania is this. A lot of votes went to Jackie Lambie-like parties, to Jackie Lambie herself and to Jackie Lambie-like parties. If the Conservative Party does not reform itself within the party, then it will be reformed outside the party. And that is exactly what you're seeing in the United States with the rise of Donald Trump and others. That if you don't take care of your base, if you don't decide what it is you stand for, what your principles are, where you will be on certain issues, then other parties, smaller independents, will do it for you.
Good point.
Well, I think that's a good point to end on with comments by both Aaron and Carolyn. We could have taken more questions, but we always finish on time, and it's been a very lively evening. So we're very grateful to Carolyn Owen from The Australian and Aaron Patrick from The Australian Financial Review for coming along tonight. On the second occasion, they share their views after the election, having previously heard their views before the election. And I think their views have held up well before the election, and I think hold up well tonight. So many thanks to both of you, and no doubt we'll have you back in the future. You're both authors of books, and no doubt there'll be more books coming out. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.